Welcome to the Dreamer by Night podcast. Today we are talking about grief. On The Colbert Show, promoting his new movie, Tick, Tick, Boom, Andrew Garfield had a powerful response when asked about his recently late mother. This is all of the unexpressed love. The grief will remain with us until we pass because we never get enough time with each other, whether someone lives until 15 or 60 or 99. I hope this grief stays with me because it's all of the unexpressed love that I didn't get to tell her. This film, Tick, Tick, Boom, is to do with this ticking clock that we all have, where we all know somewhere deep down that life is sacred, life is short, and we better just be here as much as possible with each other, holding on to each other. His words struck deep with anyone who has ever experienced the ever-complex and challenging emotion, grief. Grieving is painful, it's impossible, it's tragic. Its technical definition, a deep and poignant distress caused by or as if by bereavement. I sat down with Nasreen Ahmed, grief coach and all-around stellar human being, to talk more about the roller coaster that is experiencing grief.
Welcome. It's great to talk to you after, well, we've talked in the past year, but in the context of Dreamer by Night, it's been about a year and 1 month. We met because I saw your social media page and it was very fresh after my aunt's death and I loved everything on there and I felt very comforted by everything you were putting up. And so I reached out to you, and what's funny is I reached out to you not knowing you had the same name as my late aunt. And when we got on the call, I don't know if you got very emotional because it felt like fate that the person that I lost and loved so much has the same name of the person that helped me through it. And our conversation was so good and so impactful that I ended up being your patient for a few months, which was a lifesaver. And so I want to ask, how did you get into this work?
First of all, I want to just say thank you for having me here today and for reaching out to me in the first place. Like, I remember getting your email and being like, what? Oh, this is interesting. And yeah, I so enjoyed working with you and getting to know you in, you know, various forms and various ways. How did I get into this work? Most people who work in grief, it was never something that I was like, I'm going to go work in grief today. Like, that's what I want to do when I grow up. You know, it was very much through my own loss. So my sister Naveen died at the end of 2013. She was 37 and she died very suddenly. And I had literally never lost anyone in my immediate family and had been very lucky that I hadn't lost a lot of people in my life in general. And so to lose her, I was just like, I don't know how to breathe right now. Like, how am I supposed to like live the rest of my life without the person that I've known my whole life? You know, I mean, she's my older sister. She was always there. And so I spent a lot of time doing the things that you're supposed to do. You know what I mean? And talking to therapists and going to support groups and trying to find, some relief, you know, and all that I did. You know, I always say it was helpful to a certain extent. You know, I feel like I got what I needed, or I wasn't getting quite what I needed, but I was getting some help, you know, and it wasn't until I found out about grief coaching and actually worked with a grief coach that I felt like I got what I actually needed. So I had decided in soon after she passed away, I decided to go into coaching because I had worked in a career that was wonderful in a lot of ways, but really not fulfilling. And so I went into a year-long coach training program, and it was there that I found out about grief coaching. And then a few months later, I finally got up the courage to call the grief coach. And then maybe a month or two after that, I finally got the courage to actually hire her. and it was that work that really helped me feel like it was more than just like going to a therapist and talking, you know, and it was more than just going to a support group where we were doing like collages or like a memory book, you know. It was actual like tools that I could use to help me process and help me learn how to heal, you know. And a lot of the work that I did with her was about forgiving myself and forgiving my sister and really accepting that, you know, even though our relationship wasn't all that I had wished it had been, that it was still a loving relationship and that, you know, there was still a bond. And I didn't have to question that, you know, and I didn't have to beat myself up, even if I hadn't done all that I had wished I had done or hadn't said all that I wish I'd said. So, so it was incredibly cathartic experience for me. And I, once I had gone through that, I was like, I never imagined that I would feel the peace that I do, you know, and I want to give that to other people. I want other people to know it's possible, you know, because I think so many of us never fully process our grief, and it becomes a burden, you know, kind of this weight that we don't always recognize we're carrying, you know, and it lives with us and within us for the rest of our lives, you know, and I'm not here to tell you like you'll get over grief, but if you are able to process it and resolve it, then it doesn't have to weigh you down, you know, in quite the same way. And so, got trained specifically in grief coaching and have done a number of programs since then. And just feel very fortunate and proud to be able to do what I do.
I think you actually said something like that to me in one of our sessions. I was like, I don't remember what I said something along the lines of like, I can't wait till I like don't feel like this. And you're like, unfortunately, you're gonna feel it always. But you said the main thing is learning to live your life with it. Mm-hmm. And it's also okay to move forward. It doesn't mean to move on. You made me feel like it's okay. Like it's okay to, you know, just because you're not crying every day does not mean that you're not feeling it. So if your sister's passing was your first kind of major loss, all loss is major, but, you know, maybe most impactful loss, what did, you know, because at the time you didn't have all the knowledge you have now, what did those first few days and months look like for you? And do you find now, knowing what you know, do you look back and think, oh, okay, I wish I had these tools then?
Mm. That's a really good question. So the first few days and months was just utter breakdown and chaos and crying, and like literally I would catch myself not breathing and like have to remind myself to breathe. You know what I mean? Like it was you know, capital T trauma for me. You know, it was very traumatic, and I feel like I was in a haze most of the time. And so, yeah, so it was incredibly difficult. And like, I do remember just a lot of trying to figure out how to make it through the day. I did spend a lot of time, luckily I was in California at the time, so I lived out in San Francisco. And even though I was like desperate to get out of there because she passed away in San Francisco, I also was like not super eager to come back to New York because it was December. And I was like, I don't mind the sun. I don't mind, you know, the warm weather right now. And so one of the things that I really focused on was like taking my dog to the beach and like going hiking and like just trying to be out and active and in nature as much as possible. Like I felt the most calm during those moments, you know. Like when I was just sitting at home, it felt very isolated and very down and dark, you know. I remember the apartment wasn't terribly dark in and of itself, but when I think about it now, it's like it feels very dark, you know, and I remember feeling that at the time. And so, yeah, I think it just felt very like much trying to be very much in survival mode, just trying to make it through the day. And I wasn't working, like, so I had she passed away on a Saturday, and I was in actually the middle of my work day because I worked on weekends there at the ballet in San Francisco. And I got a phone call in between shows, and I was like, I'm leaving forever. Bye. You know, and I knew instantly I wasn't going to stay in San Francisco much longer because I'd only lived there for about 2 years at that point. And so, for the few months, it was basically doing all the things I had to do, like to take care of her affairs, making the phone calls, you know, figuring out pension, stuff like that from her union, communicating with my family, my parents, trying to make sure, figuring out the memorial, trying to make sure all that kind of stuff was taken care of. And then also figuring out like when I was going to leave, because I was going to move back to New York. And so it was just sort of like, what do I want to do here before I go? You know, what can I get rid of and kind of stuff? And then how do I transport all my stuff and that, you know, all that kind of stuff. So there's a lot of logistics and kind of busyness in between the trauma, the trying to get through the day. And in a way that was helpful. You know, I think a lot of people find that like preparing for the services is also really helpful because it does give you something to do and it like helps you like, okay, you have a plan and you have certain things you have to take care of and phone calls and all that. And even though it's hard, it kind of puts your attention on something, right? Rather than just feeling. And so that was very helpful for me. But there were definitely a lot of moments where I was like, I'm just deep in my feeling right now. And that's, can I curse? Can I curse here? Okay, good. It's fucking awful. Like, it's fucking awful. Like, I don't want to feel this. I don't know how to feel this. I don't know how to deal with this, you know? And honestly, I don't know, like, I look back on it now and I, definitely, and honestly, I don't know, like, I look back on it now and I, definitely did a few things that I regret. So like, for example, I had a friend who was very well-meaning, you know, and had a good heart, but she, in a conversation early on, she basically told me she knew how I felt because her dog died. And I was like, no, not okay. You know, and then she said a couple other things along those lines. And I was like, I can't be your friend right now. You know, like, she didn't feel safe. You know, and I didn't know how to say that to her, but she just didn't feel like somebody I wanted to spend time with. And so she came over, surprised me one day. It happened to be the day that I had to go and get all of my sister's stuff and had to kind of start to go through that and figure out how to get it transported to my parents in Virginia. And so I was really, really kind of even more sensitive, you know, and even more like, figuring out how to breathe that day. And so when she came over, she texted me. She's like, hey, I'm just getting off the BART. I'm going to come see you. And I'm like, no, you're not. No, I really need to be alone. And so, and she had traveled like over an hour to come see me. And I was like, I'm so sorry. You can't come over. You know what I mean? And I feel bad about that now, but it was also self-protection, you know, in a way. I was like, I needed to do that. I needed to set a boundary where I was like, if I don't feel comfortable with you, I'm not going to spend my time with you. And that's just the way it is, you know? So there's some things that I feel bad about, but overall, I don't know that I would have been ready for the work that I needed to do or the work that I did later. You know what I mean? I think in that point, surviving was all I could do.
You do a beautiful job of remembering your sister, because I don't know if you remember exactly what you said, but in the magazine, when we talked last year, all you talked about was how smart she was and how savvy and brilliant and talented she was. And so, you know, even if you felt like there was the unfinished business, which there always is, you do such a good job of remembering her to the people around you. And I wanted to ask, because it's been... What year did she pass again?
2013. It's almost 10 years. Next year, so, 10 years.
Wow. So 10 years later, is there anything that you do, whatever, maybe yearly, monthly, whatever it is there any ritual or something that you follow to kind of just remember her and keep her memory alive or to even just cope?
Mm-hmm. For sure. I mean, you know, it's funny, like when I first started in my coach training program, there was somebody in the program, one of the head trainers, who had gone through a lot of grief, and she wasn't necessarily a grief coach, but I felt really safe talking to her. So I had a conversation with her. And one of the things that she'd asked me in that conversation that I was not ready for was like, you know, what is the relationship you want to have now with your sister and moving forward? And I was like, huh? No. Like, I can't think about that. Like, I have not resolved all the unfinished. Like, how could I think about now and moving forward, right? But now I have. Now I do. You know, like, now I can have a sort of ongoing relationship with her. And so the two times of the year are basically her birthday and the day that she died. So those are the two days that I always sort of prepare for. You know, in terms of like, okay, I know they're coming. I know I'm going to feel a little anxious. I'm going to be upset. Actually, last year, 2021, on her birthday, was the first year that I didn't feel upset. And I actually was happy to be working. You know what I mean? Like, a lot of my work feels like it honors her, you know, and is sort of in, is because of her. You know, and so that day in particular, I remember June 10th, 2021, I was just like, oh, I feel so like happy to be working and to be able to honor her in this way. And I spend both those days, I spend either thinking about her or talking about her, talking to her. Very often I will send a donation to her favorite pet charity. And yeah, I mean, I really try as sort of an ongoing, like not necessarily on a specific day, but like just ongoing. I try to take forward the lessons I learned from my relationship with her and the lessons I learned after she died, and apply that to my current relationships. You know, so I'm much more compassionate with people than I used to be. I'm much more compassionate with myself. I try never to, I try not to get too petty with my husband, even though it can be really easy sometimes. I try to just have the mindset of like, look, this is not that big of a deal at the end of the day. And what's really important to me is that he knows I love him and that I care for him. And, you know, I want to be with him and I want to have a healthy relationship. And I think about that a lot. It's like, how can I have a healthy relationship and make sure the people that I care about know how much I care about them? You know, like that's really critical to me now. So those are the kinds of things that I think about when I think about honoring her. It's like those special occasions or special days, but also like living my life a certain way and being a certain kind of person. I think those are the bigger things that I try to focus on that feels like I am honoring her.
Yeah, almost like your whole career and life is like a monument to her now.
Huge. Huge. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I like the amount of like left turns that I took, you know what I mean, as a result of her death and the things that I've created in my life, you know, as a result of the grief, I think are like I can't, or they're undeniable. You know, I can't emphasize enough like how much it is as a result of her, you know, and what I learned.
I completely, that's kind of how, you know, how you mentioned that the two big days that you guys focus on or that you focus on is the birthday and the death anniversary. That's what we did this past year with my aunt. On her death anniversary, we went to the grave and we just kind of sat there for a bit. And then her birthday was actually just 2 weeks later. And for her birthday, we again met. And my brother and his wife got there a little bit before we did. And when we were younger, my aunt's biggest thing with us was like rock and roll. She was a huge, and I'm the same way, huge music snob. And she like ingrained in us from like day one, like Aerosmith is the best band. And all this modern rap and rock that you guys listen to that you claim is music is not music. And so, you know, my brother and his wife got there a little early. And when we got out of the car, my brother, he said, you know, while we were waiting, we listened to Aerosmith and it just felt really fitting. But yeah, I mean, a year and 10 years, it's never enough distance, you know, it always feels too fresh. But, you know, I see people around me that cope so differently. So I was curious, what is the most common, I would say even first few months. So now, you know, almost 10 years into your work, or at least 10 years after, once you've started the work internally and externally, what different types of manifestations of grief do you see most commonly?
You know, I mean, I think what you're saying is really key in that it's so different for everyone. You know, I mean, like, I think there's a lot of themes that are very similar, but some people try to avoid grief as much as possible. You know what I mean? Like, I think a lot of people are like, I can't deal with this, let's shut it down, right? And they try to compartmentalize and they try to like put on a front and they're fine, even to themselves, right? Like a lot of times we put on this facade to other people. No, we're trying to put it on for ourselves at this point, right? And we're just trying to like get to the day and we're fine, we're not gonna deal with it. Like we shove it under the rug, right? And I think other people, kind of like you, are very proactive. Like I want to address this. I want to learn how to process this. I need to learn how to live with this, you know, and what can I do and who can I talk to and what kind of steps can I take? And then there are definitely other people who are the fall apart. I can't handle this. Like, you know, everything crumbles, you know? And so I think it really depends on the person. It depends on where they are in life. It depends on, you know, their perspective or outlook, also culture and gender. I mean, there's so many different factors that play into how we deal with grief. And also, if you've ever gone through grief before, you know, how often you've gone or how many losses you've experienced, whether it's a death or other kinds of losses, you know, there's so many different factors that play into how we go through it. And I think it really just also boils down to like personality, you know, like a lot of people. My mother, for example, you know, she would always say, I'm not strong enough to handle this, you know, and if that's your internal dialogue, then you're right. You know what I mean? And so those might be the people that tend to fall apart, you know, or have everything sort of fall apart around them and never fully recover or integrate, you know, their loss. I don't know if there's any like more common way rather than sort of these like generic threads, you know what I mean, of like here's like one sort of camp and then another and then another. And I mean, you know, you might go from one camp to the other depending on the day and depending on your mood and what else happens in your life or is happening in your life. And so not that any of them are wrong. I think the most important thing is to recognize that this is a marathon, you know what I mean? And even if you're in one camp for a little while, if you think that you're not strong enough for a little while, to try not to stay there for too long, you know? I literally just had a conversation where it was like, there are gonna be days where it feels like it's way too much. And so it's okay to check out on those days. It's okay to use, you know, entertainment and just like watch a movie or like, you know, Netflix all day long. That's okay if you need a break, if you need a time away from grief. And then there will be days where it's like, okay, I am strong enough and I can process a little bit and I can do some of the work, and having that balance versus always avoiding, right? Always shoving it under the rug and shutting it off and not letting yourself process at all, you know? And so I think it's a matter of trying to find that balance and recognize that even though I'm in this place today, tomorrow might be very different and the next day, you know, or next month might be very different. And so recognizing that, as with any new thing that you go through, there's going to be transition and adjustment and plateaus and then, you know, going backwards for a little while and feeling like you're regressing and then you make progress again. And, you know, I think I kind of likened it to having like a newborn, you know what I mean? It's just like the ups and downs and like lack of sleep and not getting enough to eat and you can't move and, you know, like all the chaos. It might be very similar to the roller coaster of grief.
Something that you mentioned too, that we talked about this a lot when I was your patient or client, we talked about this a lot, was how culture impacts your grieving. And, you know, we come from similar religious culture backgrounds, not necessarily. You know, I know Egyptian culture is very different from Pakistani Indian culture, but in terms of the faith that typically is bigger in those regions, even at her funeral, it felt like that thing you just don't talk about. You know, at her funeral, watching my mother cry on the floor, it still felt like something I should not really talk about. And, you know, there was also the well-intentioned be strong, where people were coming up to me because I wasn't crying. So a lot of people kept saying to me, you have to stay strong for your mom. And me thinking like, I'm not crying. What more do you want from me? I'm standing here. And I don't blame a lot of people for feeling uncomfortable with talking about death. It's a very scary topic because it also reminds you that one day this is going to be me. Mm-hmm. But I have friends who have lost people. And to this day, it's maybe been a year, it's been months, whatever. And we still have not actually talked about it. Mm-hmm. And versus I've personally in my own life noticed the difference between people that share my culture or my cultural background versus people that don't. And the people that don't have reached out a lot, been like, oh, I'm thinking about her today, or I'm thinking about him today. And it's just, to me, I've noticed such a big difference. Mm-hmm.
And I think it's so like I've also experienced a lot of what you're sharing in terms of like that idea that you can't really talk about it too much, or if you do, then you just have to like mention God and how, you know, it's all in God's hands and everything's gonna be okay afterward. And you just sort of have to like, you know, push through the conversation very quickly. And And I think it's really interesting because a lot of these cultures that were that do that are also the cultures that really focus on family and society and that sort of collective aspect, right? Like America and other countries are very individualistic, right? You got to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You got to help yourself. You got to do it all by yourself. You leave the house by the time you're 18. You got to work, you know, right? And you do it all by yourself. Nobody's going to give you anything for free. Whereas, especially in Egypt, it's like, no, family is everything. Like, you are at the bottom of the list, my dear. Like, your family comes first, and you sacrifice, and you give, and you make sure everybody else is okay before you give to yourself, right? And I think I want to find the middle ground. You know what I mean? Like, I want to find a middle ground where I can be at the top of my priority list, but it doesn't mean that I don't care about my family, right? But I think it's really interesting that those cultures in particular are the ones that don't want you to talk about death, and they don't want you to talk about grief, because you're supposed to rely on other people. You're supposed to be able to share with other people. You're supposed to be able to give and receive from those people. But because there's no fixing grief, maybe because there's no one answer that's going to make you feel better, they don't want to see you suffering or in pain, whatever it is, right? There's that idea that you shouldn't talk about it. There's the idea that you shouldn't be okay, and that, you know, there's something going on. If you are okay, there's something weird going on, right? Like with your grandparents being happy for a few minutes, you know, and God forbid, right? So I think it's really kind of a disconnect within the culture that I'm supposed to, you know, want to be able to share and give to my family and focus on my family, but I can't share in the grief, you know? And I really respect the people who do reach out and who do come to me, particularly like you, who are from come from that cultural background, but who also can recognize, no, I need help. I need to be able to talk about this. I need to be able to process, because ultimately that's how we heal, is with each other, right? We heal in community, right? It's not an individual process that we can just take care of all by ourselves. And I think it's foolish to think that we can. And I think it's really detrimental to try to give that impression to other people, you know, because you're just continuing a really unhealthy trend at that point. So yeah, it is unfortunate. But I'm so glad, you know, that more and more people from these other cultures or from cultures like ours are reaching out, are recognizing that, no, like, this is something that we should talk about. This is something we need to talk about. And there's nothing wrong with me if I'm suffering. And there's nothing wrong with me if I'm okay today or if I'm happy today. You know, it's all part of the process.
What are some lessons that you've learned from your patients, clients, about yourself and your own grief journey?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think one of the biggest sort of overall lessons that I've learned is that no matter how much you've been through, you can stand up, right? You can integrate, you can recover. Right. I'm thinking of people that I've worked with that have gone through multiple losses or like heartbreaking, tragic losses. You know what I mean? And they become some of the happiest people I know. You know what I mean? Like, once they've been able to work through and process what they need to, and they have resolved what feels unfinished, that they really go on to live, you know, a life of gratitude, of peace, of remembering what's most important and who's most important, and sticking to that, you know, and finding the joy as much as they can, like seeking it out. And I think so many of us assume that when you've gone through a loss, especially if it's multiple losses or a tragic type of loss, that you're forever broken, you know, you're forever jaded, you'll never feel okay again, you shouldn't smile, right? You shouldn't feel joy. And I think it's such a fallacy. You know, I think the people who have suffered the most are also the people who can learn to enjoy the most. And that's definitely one thing that I've learned from my clients. It's like, oh, it doesn't matter, you know, what you've been through. If you are, if you have that mindset, right, that voice that's telling you you can survive this, that telling you you have to survive this and you have to learn how to walk through this and come out on the other side, then you will. Right. And it doesn't matter how much pain and how much suffering you've had. Now, I will add a slight caveat to that in terms of trauma, because a lot of people say my trauma made me stronger, and there's a lot of people out there that disagree with that. And I will say, if you have gone through a traumatic loss, or if you have experienced trauma in any form or fashion, please get the proper support. You know, a lot of coaches are trauma-informed coaches, but they're not necessarily trained to be able to support you in healing from the trauma. And so it's important to see the right kind of person for that, right kind of professional. And I think it's important to also recognize that you are not your trauma, just like you are not your losses. And so as much as you can to heal, and heal with the right people, right support, and to own your strength as a result of the work that you've done, not as a result of the tragedy that you've been through. I think in my own, like, so you asked specifically what I've learned about myself. I think I've learned my capacity to be kind and gracious, compassionate with other people, but also my job is to help push people through in a lot of ways, you know, and help move them through, because it's so easy to sit down and be like, I'm not getting up. This is where I'm going to stay, right? And so I've had to find a balance of support, but also kind of, the traditional sports coach of like, no, get up, take that extra lap, you know what I mean? Do that extra push-up. Like, we're gonna do this together, kind of a thing, you know? So I think it's taught me the kind of balance that I have to have to really be able to make a difference for people. Because at first it was just like, I just need to be compassionate and kind and patient. And it was just like, oh, that's not enough, right? That's not enough. And so there needs to be that extra layer of like, okay, and you still have to move. You still have to push through this. You still have to, you know, as much as it sucks, you still have to keep walking.
That's a really good point. It does take a lot of self-discipline, and it doesn't feel good almost ever, but it doesn't feel good in the moment, but it pays off in the long run. I just want to say that you are a beautiful and remarkable human, and I cannot recommend you enough for anyone, because you can tell that you live what you preach. And, mm-hmm. you know, I know that your sister would be slash is so proud of you and so honored by everything you've done in her name and everything you will continue to do in her name. But I want to give you a minute to just, is there anything that you want to say, any advice you have for anyone? I mean, I feel like this whole thing was advice, but anything maybe that, you want to say to anybody out there listening that's going through a really hard time.
First, thank you. I'm like almost tearing up about what you said. Thank you. It means a lot to me. I guess my two biggest pieces of advice are one, get support, right? Get whoever it is, whatever it is, get support, right? Don't try to do this alone, or at least don't try to do this alone for very long, because like I said earlier, it is a marathon. It's going to take a long time. It's going to take a lot out of you, and you need people. You need people around you. Like, that's just a fact. And it's so easy to isolate and shut down and feel like I felt like certain people aren't safe, but that doesn't mean that everybody isn't safe, and doesn't mean that everybody won't know how to hold space for your grief, you know, so definitely get support. And then the other thing is, hold on, you know, like, I mean, I just remember in the depths of my grief on those days where it was like, I can't even get up out of bed today. You know, it's so all consuming that you forget that, you know, things do change and evolve. You will change and evolve. Your grief will evolve. So allow, as much as you can, allow yourself to remember that, or try to remember that, you know, keep that in mind so that when it's really shitty, you know that maybe next month won't be, maybe it'll be 5% less shitty, right? Maybe next year will be like 5% less shitty, you know, but just as much as you can, you know that how you feel right now is not how you will always feel.
We also caught up with Haya Muhammad, full-time law student and co-founder of KXP Campaigns.
So since we last talked, there has been, you know, a little extra trauma, a little extra spice added to my life. In March of 2020, 2022. That's the year we're in, right? Mm-hmm.
I know.
In March of 2022, I lost my Nana, which would be my mom's father, so my maternal grandfather. Very suddenly, he was the youngest 78-year-old you would have ever met. And I mean climbing on windowsills to get to dusty places to clean. It was sudden and unexpected. And I have always been very aware in my life that it is a huge blessing for me to have both of my mom's parents and my dad's mother and my grandmother's mother in my life. Because as early as elementary school, I had friends whose grandparents had passed away much before they were ever in the picture. And as I grew up, I wanted to make sure that it was something that I wasn't taking for granted. It's a huge blessing. And especially throughout my adult life, like you get to 10, 11, okay. You get to 15, 16, okay. Then you get to 17, 18, 19, and your grandparents are still an active, healthy part of your life. I wanted to make sure that I wouldn't feel like I hadn't taken advantage of that once they were gone, because that's the reality of life. We know that people are going to go, and typically people older than us are going to leave first. And while sometimes it's easier to ignore that reality when time is slipping from your fingers so quickly, just always been super aware that their time on this earth, you know, was probably not going to outlive mine, and at some point in my life I would be there. And as I got older, I got more aware of like, yeah, this is gonna be something that I'm going to remember very well when it happens, right? When you're like 16 and a parent or a grandparent passes away, that's something that's not gonna be a blur in your lifetime memory. Like at that point you remember things very well. So long way of saying that I knew it was going to happen, and I wanted to make sure that I was ready for it when it did.
But you weren't ready because it was unexpected.
I was by no means ready.
So how was this different for you? Because the other two losses that you described in grief, one was by suicide and one was by old age, right?
Right.
And so how did coping with this one, and how did those initial feelings feel differently from those?
Have you ever watched a movie that's super dramatic and someone dies and, you know, a loved ones of theirs are just freaking out, mm-hmm. and having like a classic mental breakdown, like throwing things and getting upset, and you watch it and you're like, this doesn't really happen in real life. While I was reacting that way, I felt like I was having an out-of-body experience, like watching myself. Mm-hmm. In the hospital, like, I threw my bag, I was hitting my uncle, like, I was having a full-blown panic attack, and I was just somewhere where my brain was still functioning. I was like, I am really putting forth an Oscar-worthy performance right now. I mean, I had driven 200 miles straight the night before. I got on a red eye. I politely pushed past people on the plane. And I ran, if you want to call my panicked half limping through the airport that. I got in an Uber that was going like 90 miles per hour on local roads for me, only for me to get there and find out that he was gone before I ever even got on that plane. And I mean, I lost it. I threw my bag. I was hitting my uncle who had just told me. I was freaking out. Now that I think about it, there was no other way to react. My great-grandmother, I always feel had left us long before she left this earth. You know, her body and her mind and her soul were really already elsewhere, and she was just doing her time here physically until God called her back. My grandfather, my Nana, he had so much life in him and so much life I felt left in him. And I know everyone wants to say that about like their grandparents or people that pass away, but he really, truly did. I don't know how else to describe it. I mean, just a few weeks before this, one of my cousins had gotten married, and he was on top of everything there. He was, you know, singing at her send-off. He was just, it was just supposed to be a surgery, you know, and then that surgery took his life. So I've seen, my Nana was a heart patient. When I was in fifth grade, my Nana had open heart surgery, bypass surgery, and he came out of it laughing, making jokes. You know, he had his health problems. Sometimes, you know, once a year there'd be like a scare at the hospital. And I'll be honest, he would just be flirting with the nurses. He would be watching TV. He'd just be hanging out, living his best life, trying to get us to sneak salt into his food. And so when they said that he had to have the surgery for his kidney, it was such a low scale thing. But he never recovered from it. Mm-hmm. And he passed away 2 days later.
Yeah. And so how has, well, one, how has it been with your family, and what has your role been, do you feel, in supporting your family through this, since it was so unexpected?
So everyone wants to tell you, for background, I guess, for background, I am my grandparents' first grandchild, and I am the, you know, eldest grandchild, first child of the eldest child. And that holds a lot of weight in terms of responsibility. And people kept trying to tell me things like, you have to be strong for your grandma, you have to be strong for your mom. Mm-hmm. But me not crying, mm-hmm, isn't going to make them not cry.
Right, exactly.
My grandma still lost her husband. My mom still lost her dad. And I lost my grandpa, you know? Yeah. And I always used to tell everyone that my grandpa is, my Nana is the first man that I've ever loved. My responsibility at that time was just being there, just being in the same house as everyone, feeling miserable with everyone, crying with everyone. There was nothing more to do. You truly go into survival mode. And for the first time, I did not feel the need to filter my feelings to make it easier for someone else, because it was one of the worst things that's ever happened to me. And I knew that I couldn't take that away from myself, because we know what happens when you leave wounds sitting for too long.
And you mentioned be strong. How do you feel about that phrase? And who do you feel like you hear it the most from?
Random people.
Not people super close.
Right. Right. Correct. Random people. When we were at the actual funeral in the masjid, we were at the janazah, and I was having a full-blown panic attack. I will own it. I was not doing hot. I was the person that was just uncontrollably sobbing, and random people are hugging me. My Nana was a pillar of the Muslim community in the Northwest suburbs. Way too many people knew and loved him. And so many people showed up to pray for him. And this one woman comes to hug me, And she said to me, "Why are you being so weak?" Let me tell you, I had driven 200 miles straight the night before this. I got in a red eye. I went straight to the hospital where I find out that he's already gone. And then I go upstairs and I sit with his dead body. And then I help with the funeral arrangements. And then I get myself to the masjid to pray over this man we're about to put in the ground. And this person is asking me, "Why are you being so weak?" He passed away probably around 6 o'clock in the morning, and we were burying him by like 2 p.m. And it has been a whirlwind in between, right? I am barely alive. Like, I remember thinking, I am barely alive. Like, I do not know what I'm doing. My roommate, who was one of my best friends, was literally physically holding me up the entire time. When we went to the viewing, my legs were not working. I was standing over him and she was holding me. So fuck your being weak. That is grief. We like to make pain poetic. And don't say that I said this, because I think I read it somewhere. Sometimes we look, for beauty and pain, but it was just red. All that red was just blood. Like, that's all it was. It was nothing more than that. And if you want to know what grief is, that's what it is. It is throwing your laptop bag at someone and screaming, crying, and banging on your uncle's chest like this is a fucking Lifetime drama. And it's trying to stand up in prayer at a janaza and not even being able to breathe because you're crying so much. And it is wanting to literally lay down and die. A piece of me was buried with him.
What does like a month later look like?
Complete and total numbness. And I was in my second semester of law school. So for me, it was very much a combination of complete numbness and survival. I was just trying to do whatever bare minimum had to be done to, one, not fail out of law school, and two, keep my heart breathing. Keep my heart beating. Those were my two objectives, and that was pretty much all I can. That's all I could focus on, because that's all I had to do. Anything beyond that was unimaginable. Mm-hmm. Every day was so fucking hard. And people lose their grandparents all the time. It's okay. It happens at some point. I know that I'm not some rare story, like some rare sob story. It's a part of life. But, you know, relationships with different people and different family members vary. And for me, my Nana was very much a pivotal person in my life, you know. My first memories were with him. They always lived less than 10 minutes away, so most of my life has been spent in their home, and now everything just seems so quiet. And at the time, you know, say a month in, if you stop trying to survive, the quiet will kill you. Not to be dramatic.
It's been a year since we talked, so it's not been necessarily a year since the loss of your friend and your great-grandmother, but a year since we last talked about it. What does remembering them specifically look like today, now with distance?
So my great-grandmother is actually buried right next to her husband, who is right next to my Nana. So I try to go and visit my Nana frequently, and everyone gets flowers. I don't want anyone to feel left out. And so in that regard, regarding my Amma, regarding my great-grandmother, I feel like now the sense of responsibility I have to continue making du'a for her, continue going to, I'm trying to think of the English word, but to say salam to her at her grave, has kind of been renewed, because I want to make sure that I never stop doing it for my Nana. Mm-hmm. And obviously when I'm there, I always think like, they're going to be so offended. Like, she came for his hawk, but she didn't say anything to us. So in that way, I think I have a renewed sense of gratefulness. My Amma's death was really, and maybe this contradicts what I said earlier, but it felt poetic because we had been waiting for it for so long that it was just like watching a movie scene that maybe you shot a really long time ago, but it wasn't, you know, put into production until much later. It was almost rehearsed. Like, we knew it was going to happen and what would happen when it happens. And Callie, I think the way that I think about Callie, who took her own life, probably won't change much. I'll always have a level of anger when I think about her. There is so much that I wish I could share with her. I still have her phone number saved in my phone, and anytime, it happens at least 3 times a day when I'm going to look, search something in my phone, and the first thing that comes up is Callie. I know that healing is not linear and doesn't necessarily have an endpoint, but in regards to her, I feel like at this point, I still am in the same place as I was when we first talked about it. And to be completely honest, I still never went to visit her, which I think is something I mentioned in the edition.
You did, yeah.
And why I can go, you know, sit at the graveyard with my grandfather for an hour, but not go to the church where she is beyond me. But maybe I'm keeping a competition with myself. How long can I go without going to visit Callie?
I think what you had said, at least in our interview, was something along the lines of, like, it was anger that she didn't need to be there. It was anger that she should be here with you.
Yeah, so what's the average life expectancy these days? Maybe I'll go when I'm about 75, because it'll seem, inshallah,
long life.
It'll seem more acceptable for her to be there then, maybe. Yeah.
And how do you, a few months after, remember your Nana?
I remember my Nana as a light in my life. Life is obviously moving along and things are changing, and this world that he worked so hard to build has to now learn to survive without him. Mm-hmm. He was very much what made the ecosystem of our community and our lives thrive, and right now, at this point in my grief, I just feel immense emptiness. I go to my grandparents' house every week to spend time with my nani, my grandmother, and it just seems so empty. I spent 25 years of my life, so my entire life, in and out of that house, and without him there, not to be stupid, but it's like something died. Something in the house died. The spirit of the house So it's definitely emptiness. I feel emptiness, you know, in the house where all of his things used to be. There's an emptiness in my WhatsApp from the lack of bombarding of threads. There's a lack of emptiness in my voicemails, which he probably left me 5 every week. There's an emptiness in phone calls and trinkets and in me. And I don't necessarily want that to change. I don't know if I want to stop feeling his absence, because I think for me that thought is really scary, because I'm afraid that if I stop feeling his absence, it'll mean that I've forgotten what it's like to feel his presence.
What is the one thing you've learned that grief and loss has taught you about life and living?
I am someone that in the moment of a good moment that you know you want to remember forever, I like to hold on to that moment however I can so that I can remember it later. So I'm the person with my phone out, recording everything all the time. I'm the person making little notes to myself in my phone, and all those little clips and random pictures of my grandfather that I'm finding now doing the most mundane things. I have a video of him washing mint. Why did I take a video of him washing mint? But now I watch that and my heart actually aches. And to answer your question, I think grief and loss have taught me to never let anyone make me feel bad about wanting to hold on to bits of my life that in the moment I know are going to mean a lot later. Those random pictures and notes in my phone are very much what have been getting me through this time. I have saved every voicemail. And that's a lot of fucking voicemails. Man really liked to leave me voicemails. I have a voicemail for everything. I have voicemails for when he's mad. I have voicemails for Eid Mubarak. I have voicemails where he thought I answered the phone and he just kept talking. So I'm not going to let anyone make me feel bad about, why are you always recording? Because I'm going to miss you one day, bitch. And I want to have this to hold on to.
If you or a loved one have recently lost somebody, or you're experiencing grief of any kind, visit harborlightcoaching.com or visit psychologytoday.com to find support groups near you. See you next time.